Sharkcast Radio would not be possible without the generous support of Dyson Logistics.
Dyson Logistics provides tailored logistical solutions to meet individual client needs and is set apart by its personalized service.
Dyson has a strong worldwide agent network, enabling highly competitive rates. Find them online at www.dysonlogistics.com or call them 8399 1844.
Dyson Logistics, service delivered. Buying or selling a property is one of the most stressful undertakings that you can do in your entire life. Luckily, Sharkcast Radio is supported by one of the best and most honest real estate agents in the Sutherland Shire market and is an expert in the North Caringbah region. I sold my property with Jason Hawes from Cripps & Cripps Real Estate and could not have been happier with the outcome. Call Jason on 0410-417-450. That's Jason from Cripps & Cripps Real Estate, 0410-417-450. Sharkies! 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 Sharkies!
Sharkies! Sharkies! They've got the ball over the line! Sharkies! Take your porch lights off because they're coming out with a trophy!
Hello and welcome to this special deep dive episode of Sharkcast Radio, where we fire up the DeLorean and head back in time, where we do a deep investigation into a particular season for the club. And this is one we've been looking forward to for a long, long time, Sam. We're going to fire up the DeLorean, put the coordinates in for 2002. And we're joined by the great Brett Camorley. How are you, mate?
I'm good, man. How are things?
We're down here at the Yacht Club today. It's about 10 in the morning, and our major sponsor, the Royal Motor Yacht Club, and it is absolutely sensational down here, isn't it, Samuel?
It sure is. We want to thank Brett for coming along, and it's going to be a great, great yarn, as they say in the classics.
Don't forget, you can email us at sharkcastpod@gmail.com or get us Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at sharkcastpod. And our sponsors, don't forget those. Of course, the Royal Motor Yacht Club, Port Hacking, Dyson Logistics, one of the great Brett Camorley supporters, Kane Dyson, and Jason Hawes from Cripps & Cripps Real Estate. So, 2002, Sam, outside of footy, what do you remember? John Howard was Prime Minister.
Was he?
We're in the shadows of 2000 Olympics.
One of the great dragons, John Howard.
Yeah. What do you remember?
I was a musician full-time back then.
Were you being paid... being paid by Johnny Howard?
I wasn't being paid by many people, actually.
That's probably why he doesn't remember it, if he's a magician full-time.
That's what I'm hinting at, Brett.
Probably a good life.
It was a different life, a young life, coming out of the Olympics, and as a Sharks fan...
Pretty positive days, right?
Yeah, the John Lang era, which we might talk about a little bit, but yeah. Heading into a new era with a couple of men entering the club.
So let's talk about that, Brett. You had... done a lot in the game at that point. You'd played for Australia, you'd played Origin, won a premiership, you'd been at the Knights, the mighty Hunter Mariners, the Melbourne Storm, and then the Northern Eagles. So you'd been around the block. You signed for Cronulla. What did you think of the club as an outsider before you arrived?
Yeah, obviously I got to play with Johnny Lang, actually. I got picked to play on the Australian Super League test team in 97. And obviously met Johnny Lang there. He was there as the Australian coach and thought he was a really good coach. Obviously, the culture of Cronulla was they had, I played a lot of reserve grade games coming through, or lower grade games coming through the night system. We played several years in a row where it was always grand finals against the Sharks. Yeah. So a lot of those kids had progressed through and were sort of first grade footy players. It was obviously as an outsider coming in, playing Shark Park on a Saturday night was obviously always going to be a tough challenge, a full house and a bit of a party occasion. So it was... that was sort of what I remember. Technically, my reason for joining the Cronulla Sharks was the fact that, you're right, I'd spent 3 years at the Melbourne Storm under Chris Anderson, a physio by the name of Tony Abe and a trainer by the name of Aaron Salisbury. And those three men had all signed to come to the Sharks in 2002. And for me, I'd left Melbourne the end of 2000, probably at the top of my career, as you said, grand final, made my Australian debut in 99. Played New South Wales in 2000, so I thought, anywhere you went, they were all going to be similar clubs. Chose to go to the Northern Eagles to start a family, as close to Newcastle as I could get, with Andrew being the Knights halfback and probably a pretty good player at that stage, and was end up being, become a seventh immortal or fifth immortal, I think it is, an immortal in some capacity. So, so I made the decision to go home and start a family, and as you know, I'd gone from the Knights that were successful, the Mariners that were successful, the Melbourne Storm that was successful. I just thought every club was pretty similar. And, you know, if you trained hard and backed yourself, you'd all be successful. So that was a really disappointing year. My football had gone backwards a long way. I wasn't enjoying it. You know, and I'd signed a 4-year deal for the Northern Eagles. And then, you know, Chris Anderson gets a job to come to the Cronulla Sharks. And you know, they had the option if you wanted to stay with Manly once the license went back to them, or you could go and find a new home. So I sort of selected to start a new, or find a new home. I knew that Chris Anderson and especially the two physio and trainers would probably get my football back to where I thought I'd wanted it to become. And that was purely the reason why I joined the Cronulla Sharks.
Cronulla hadn't had a history of signing big-name marquee players up until that point. They'd made do with, fair to say, Samuel, they'd made do with local
that
juniors.
That era of Lang was all about the juniors coming through, and they were lucky that it was a good batch.
But a player of your reputation, played for Australia, should have been met with excitement, yet because there was a fair halfback there in Preston Campbell, it was a divisive move, and it wasn't... You weren't exactly met with open arms.
No, I certainly was told to piss off pretty quickly in the off season. I think I'd signed with Chris about a day or two before he'd gone to England to be the Australian coach. So Matthew Johns and I Matthew had already signed, and I travelled with Matthew quite a bit for the off season because Matthew still travelled from Newcastle for the off season. I travelled from Central Coast. We'd come down, sort of do a 2-day stint in Sydney and stay with Phil Bailey, and then sort of go back home on Tuesday night and come back. But it was met with huge opposition. As you said, like a lot of the kids when we were training, people in the street, I was told to piss off pretty quickly.
So people actually in the street would yell out.
Yeah, know. Pretty much, yeah. You know, we don't want you. And as you said, you know, Preston Campbell had got the Dally M in 01, had a sensational season and was the halfback at the time too. So I suppose people very quickly, I suppose, put it together that, you know, if I'm signed to come here under Chris, then I'm going to play halfback and Preston was going to play a different position. So, you know, it was a tough start to the off season.
So how did that make you feel when you, did you think, what have I done here? This is a mistake.
Oh, yeah, definitely not. And at that stage, I'd say I wasn't super confident in my career because I'd had such a bad year. Well, not bad year in 01. I think I still played one game for New South Wales, but my standards weren't the same height or what my confidence probably wasn't the same as what it was when I would have been leaving Melbourne on the back of, you know, three successful or four successful years on the back of Hunter Mariner. So it was, yeah, I'd come here to restart my career again, and I'd had a 1-year contract as well, so pressure was on very quickly. You know, and then it made me resilient in some way and obviously motivated. You know, I knew I could play good football under Chris. I knew the style of football that he liked to coach. So I had no doubt that would get back. It probably that wasn't the hardest part of the season. It was, I think I'd played a City versus Country match on a Friday night somewhere a few hours away, and we'd flown back. I think we'd played Sunday afternoon at Shark Park, and we were on the verge of, I suppose, most losses in a club history. Being booed off Shark Park whilst being replaced halfway through the second half was probably. And that was the lowest point of 02 for me. That was when I'd started having some doubts and questions and you know, maybe thought the career was at huge crossroads.
I remember that quite vividly. You had played City Country like a Friday night.
Yeah. In the old days, you'd play Friday night and you're expected to back up and go home and play for your clubs and on a Saturday or Sunday.
It wasn't going well. I think it was against Parramatta that game, and it wasn't going well. And Opes pulled you off because you were pretty tired, and it was a pretty hostile reception.
Would you say it's a little bit un-Cronulla like that kind of hostility in the history of the club?
Well, yeah, I can't remember.
Like getting harassed in the street.
Yeah, getting harassed in the street, and it was just strange because...
I thought this Shire place was a nice place.
Yeah. I mean, when you look at it objectively, the team made the prelim in 2001 under a great season with Preston and co. And then you get, you know, a coach come along who's highly credentialed coach, a test halfback. Mm. You would think that people would think we're only going to improve from there, but that wasn't the vibe. It was very much, he's coming to take Preston's spot. This sucks. Mm. This is no good. And then he's getting booed off. I mean, it's quite bizarre in retrospect.
Well, we'll get there soon enough, but the fans will quick quickly turn.
Yes, that was quite amazing. But let's go back to the start of the season. I remember it was a shift in the playing style.
Yeah.
The flat attack.
You guys are all about the flat, Brett. Tell us about the flat attack.
Tell us about the flat attack.
No, I think it was obviously a style that Chris Anderson coached. It was a style of rugby league that came out of rugby union. It's pretty much playing over the advantage line, playing short momentum hit-ups and creating some momentum, and then obviously I suppose I enjoyed taking the ball to the defensive line as well. So it was probably used at best around the 98-99 sort of time frame when it was unlimited interchange, where you could always have fresh attackers and play that momentum football. So it was, as you said, changing of style rather than the deep flowing. It started to be a change of we moved from the Shark Park training to Loftus at that stage as well. So we based ourselves out of the TAFE up there and trained out of there. And that was pretty much in probably taking some words from Chris here, it was probably pretty much a change of the culture to take it from the casual, relaxed, have a bit of fun sort of place to what needed to be done to be, I suppose, turn them into a premiership. So change was the biggest objective that they didn't like. And then playing style was a big input as well.
Coming in as an outsider, did you feel that Chris Anderson was very clear on record that the culture needed to change at Cronulla? It was a nice place to be, a bit of fun, but it wasn't a winning culture. Did you feel that was true?
I don't think you feel it as a young kid. And as you said, I had my own problems to worry about. The coming in was about just playing good brand of football. I always thought if you played good football and trained hard, or training hard allows you to play good football. So training hard and being mates, I suppose, is a big part of culture. And then obviously it was making that culture change, getting people to think about club first more than individual first, and then success comes. So, I know in 2003, obviously, was when the club made a decision, obviously, to move Chris on halfway through 2003. So that obviously got to a stage where they wanted to change, and they wanted to go to try and get better in summary, not better, but try and take that next step to win a grand final, because we still hadn't won one at that stage. And it was obviously met very head on by non-supportive people. And then, even 2003, when Chris sort of struggled and was moved on, it was probably, in a way, an unsuccessful stint in a coach coming here. And as you said, a coach that had won both Northern and Southern Hemisphere and was the Australian coach. As you said, it was a different style. I think that it's so funny now, if you think about football in 2020, that's the style we should be playing. Flat over the ad line, create momentum, short passes, all in a straight line supporting and get the defence going backwards. So it's a simple game, I think. We just we complicate sometimes. And you talk about 2002 being very much a very flat style. I know by 2005, 2006, it certainly changed big time when the defence become the biggest part of the game, and you had to learn how to play deep and slow, which is pretty hard to sometimes to change a habit of playing flat and fast for so often, and then and kicking the ball to the corner. So, as you said, I remember some great clashes, probably more against in 2002 about against Newcastle, which was a club that I'd come through, and obviously loved playing against Andrew because we had that rivalry. But obviously then having Matthew Johns playing 5'8" for us, playing against his old club for the first time. I don't think it was a very good celebration for Matty that night.
No, so yeah, we there's a couple of
both Newcastle games were bizarre,
very bizarre. Yeah. Let's talk
again,
about that.
We talk about that football god. Yeah. It was once in favour for them and once hugely in favour for us.
So we went up there first time round and got absolutely
hammered.
That's
when the pressure started to come on. There'd been a couple of close losses, early doors, but you could see the potential. Then all of a sudden, you go to Newcastle and lose 52-8.
Yeah, that was the start of 7-game losing streak.
Yeah. And that was not a good day out by anyone's reckoning, and that's when the pressure started to come.
Yeah, right. And then sometimes maybe you lose close and bits and pieces, and you don't think you're going too bad. But obviously, when your scoreline is that bad, it's we've got to change. It's a reason for change. The fans know that you're going horrible because the scoreline says it to you. You can't hide it. You can't go with people and say, "Oh, we're not that far off. We're going okay." About we're getting a bit of unluckiness. But when you get flogged, it hurts your own pride. It certainly shatters your confidence. And the one thing I learned probably more in that year. You know, I'd had a few setbacks in my career earlier, but from sort of 97, I played for the Mariners for middle of the year, to 98, to 99, 2000, everything was good. Like, there was no road, there was no setbacks, no road challenges, no, we might have won it. We might have lost a game here or there, but it was like, oh, we're sweet. You know, we're always going to be successful. Yeah. We'll win next week and then win in about 5 weeks after that. So 02 was the first time I'd had that consistent streak of train hard, why are we losing, having lots of meetings, players getting shitty, senior players getting dropped, and the understanding, I suppose, of how hard it is to play NRL continuously, but obviously probably how hard it is to coach and create a winning environment, which is hard to do when you're losing.
Was that your worst losing streak in your career?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And there was some fair scores racked up in that point. I mean, lost to the Bulldogs 48-22, lost to Parramatta 36-6. That was the game where you were pulled off at half time, so that was no good. Lost the Warriors 42-20, so it was the wheels really fell off in terms of not even getting close.
That's right, yeah. And again, like, you know, as I said, I thought we were super fit. You know, I come here to probably under one of the hardest trainers I've ever had in my career, and you know, there was still a bit of the old Cronulla people still here. You know, I remember Dean Treister and Nick Graham were still very important for us. Chris McKenna, Paul Miller. David Peachy, so there's still quite a lot of the old players, not old players, but the players that were regularly
been around for a long while.
So Jason Stevens, yeah, we bought Denny Nutley, I think, at that time. You know,
it was a good team. 02 was a good team. It was a mixture of, as you say, the older guys. Then we had Johns, Kamali, and some younger guys coming through. And
Nutley was a great acquisition. You know, he was that.
Phil Bailey. Phil Bailey goes off to play for Australia. Greg Bird. Arrived at the club at that time as well as a young kid.
So you go from losing 42-20 to the Warriors to turning it around to a 34-13 win against St. George Illawarra. Now, and they were winning 13-0 at halftime.
I remember that game. James Howard kicks a field goal at halftime from the scrum.
Yes. Yep.
And I don't know why, but for some reason it was... Because that was at Shark Park.
Yeah.
It was a packed house, obviously always is against the Dragons, and that was probably the first time I'd played a local derby. And it was insane, the excitement of a local derby, because I'd never had one before. And then I remember him kicking the field goal at half time, and it made no sense to me, but it gave me a lot of confidence.
Mm. Felt like a loser's play.
Oh, I don't know. It just was like, oh, well.
I remember thinking that at the time.
I think they put the cue in the rack, but all of a sudden it was like, you walk off like, oh, well, you know.
It's also a bit arrogant too.
Chris's biggest strength, and I'll give Chris... You know, the reason why we won the grand final in 99, I always said, is he comes in the sheds at halftime and pretty much says, you know, we've played as bad as we could ever play. You know, let's just relax, play a bit of footy and not let this occasion go by. And, you know, you come in at 13-0, and as you said, it was on the back of 7 losses in a row. The biggest thing we did in all those losses, I suppose, was we'd lock ourselves in boardrooms, we'd hang out together, we'd have a beer, we'd go to the pub and try and sort the problems as adults. And as you said, for some reason, when it turned in a bizarre manner, but it turned quickly and turned successfully very, very quick. You know, I remember winning that game, and I suppose all your doubts had gone then, and all your confidence had come back. And I think because we'd hung tough and got through it all together, I think that was the biggest part about why we're able to rally and push on to a successful year.
Now, I don't have your stats in front of me from that game, but I do remember you having a lights-out second half, you personally. You led them around very well, and that goes on to an 11-match winning streak.
Yeah.
And I think at that point, that's when the people in the streets start tapping you on the back rather than throwing stuff at you. And
I don't think, you know what, the funny thing is, I think I left the club in...
I left the club in 08. 08, yeah.
And it was funny... It was actually a sense of achievement when I'd left the club in 08, because I actually had people say thank you for your time at the place. Because you talked about when I arrived in December to come and do bloody get flogged at Shark Park over the back there and get school kids telling you to piss off to 15,000 people on a Sunday afternoon when you're playing your heart out and you're trying and you're getting beaten and you're getting booed off. To then, as you said, it turned and they started believing, and you know, the excitement of when finals arrive. Every fan gets excited for when the finals start. Yeah. But the sense of people saying thank you when I left, I felt like it was a... it made me feel proud, I suppose, of that I didn't kick stones and
yeah,
and pack up and go home after being told to go home.
Well, you broke records.
Yeah.
And you played a number of years there. I was thinking about it, Adam, on the way here. Like, Gallen, maybe. Who else is, and excuse this word, who else has tried harder for the Sharks? This guy was just like a little dog running around the whole time.
One of the things I loved about your game was you used like a bull terrier on the kick chase. Always the first one down, yeah, trying to pin
he
down.
Still looks pretty fit too, by the way.
Pin down the fullback, leading by example. Yeah, like the game. Your game was built on effort, which, and you always put
that's
the word
effort
in week in, week out. And I want to talk about the public sentiment changing. There was a game against the Northern Eagles, which would have been, you would have marked, you know, in your calendar, over at Brookvale.
Yeah.
Again, yeah, they go up something like 20-6 at half time. And we rampage home. Again, you play a fantastic and win 46-24.
Yeah.
And I remember the travelling supporters went naughty, naughty, naughty. Yeah. And I'm like, you guys were booing this guy like 6 weeks ago. It's amazing how fickle supporters can be. But that was a day out.
It was. And again, I think that's, if you train really hard and you're super fit, you can have those second halves because you're not gone out of the game at halftime. And I was never a player that ever thought we were out of the game. And as you said, I think I'm most proudest of my career because I think I could honestly hold my hand up at the end of it and say, I think I had a dig in every match. And
yeah, 100%.
And as you said, like, if I had a dig, I was extremely proud. So when the whistle went at kickoff, I had no, and I've heard people in the past, I had no bullshit excuses for when the whistle blew. What Melbourne taught me, and again, I refer to some things to Melbourne. Melbourne created a trigger in my life, which was we warmed up inside for the first time ever. So we didn't go out in the field to kick the ball around 30 minutes before the game and see the crowd and have a bit of fun. And so all of a sudden, because we arrive in Melbourne, we warm up indoor in a place called the Glasshouse next to the sponsors to try and sell rugby league to a new fan group. So you never got that excitement of going out in the park and, you know, kickers have got to practice their kicking because they've only been there for 3 years beforehand and they don't know what the field looks like. but it made me understand that it didn't really matter what, you know, did I sleep good the night before? Did I have my pasta at lunchtime? Did all these little things. You know, I was a creature of habit in some regards. I made sure I did 3 kicking sessions a week because, as you said, that I felt like that was a hugely important part of my game. I wanted to be the best kicker in the competition, so I had to practice hard. So, and then, you know, I wasn't the biggest guy. I couldn't sort of blow you away for sidesteps and bits and pieces, and I learned how to manage a game. But, you know, I always thought if you had a dig, then you're proud. So, I think playing flat style of football allows you to score points quickly. Because once you get the defense going backwards, it's not risky. It's not triple cutout passes. It's not block plays for block plays for block plays and a lot of people in shape. It's just literally playing a lot of 3-on-2s, 2-on-1s continuously. And
just try to bowl over the top of
them. Bowl over the top of them, and then eventually you did. So I think that's why a lot of times when we scored, we'd scored continuously because you just played eyes up football. You had fun. You supported each other. And again, I'll go back to you, we were super fit.
Now, let's roll forward. We're into an 11-game winning streak, which is the longest in the club's history at that point. Part of the way through it, it's a Sunday afternoon at Shark Park against Newcastle, your junior club.
Yep.
They'd pumped us earlier in the year, 52-8, and it's a day out for the books. What's your memory of that?
Yeah, again, a great day that just started extremely well. Sunny afternoon. And again, I love those challenges. You know, playing against Andrew for me was the biggest challenge I had in my whole career. You know, I had to leave Newcastle to see if I was good enough to play rugby league, and then he certainly played a much different style probably to me. You know, in some regards, and so it was a nice day out. 3 tries, I believe it was. I'm gonna say what's that? I ended up 28, so 8 goals, 3 tries, 8 goals.
Not bad going, is it?
I still layer up with my kids. I got the coaster at home, and it's still got the point scoring in a match.
Scoring record.
Yeah.
The Paul Mellor try. I was right in front of that when it happened.
Now that was a moment where Paul Mellor goes up the Western touchline.
Beats about 5. Is that right?
He kept palming off.
There was one. Like
yeah.
That. I mean that. That game gave all fans belief. It was like, whoa, look at this. We might have a team here.
So in the squad, are you now thinking, well, we can do anything?
I don't think I ever had too many parts in my career where I start a season not thinking we're going to go good. And as you said, once you start winning matches, and then you start dreaming and believing and bits and pieces, and as you get closer to semi-final time, if you're going good around semi-finals, you're starting to believe and dream. And I won a grand final in 99, and I've only ever got the two other grand final qualifiers three in the end when I finished, but at Cronulla, we played in two other grand final qualifiers, and it was 0-2. 0-2 and 0-8 were the two most shattering losses I had. Because you get to that stage of dreaming and believing, and especially in 0-2, we were fully fit. Now, there's some reasons, I think, in 0-8 why we got blown off the park by Melbourne. Unfortunately, that was a Greg Bird year where Greg got moved on. Brett Seymour does his knee at training when we had the bye leading into the qualifier against Melbourne. So, that was a horrendous night. And
we talked, we did the same thing with Luke Cavell about 2008. And he said he still thinks about that prelim just about every day.
Yeah, how bad
about
it was.
What could have been and
if
the
those
chance.
Two guys play, we're going through, I reckon.
Yeah. It was funny that, did he mention that we went to Coogee or Bondi or something the night before for camp or 2 days for camp or something? I don't know if that was a good move or a bad move or some regards. But you talk about 0-2. 0-2, we were flying. We'd gone through being kicked to the gutter, change of style, change of culture in some regards, a bit more resilient, a bit tougher.
Yeah.
And then getting to the semi-finals where you think you're actually starting to believe.
Well, it was a bit bizarre going into the semi-finals because round 26 is against the Roosters, who were doing much better then. We're much fancied, and we know that the following preceding week, this is
going to be the match where they barnstormed us. Freddie then catches and scores a try off an intercept that I might have thrown a pass. They blow us off the park in this match, and is this the start of their rushing style of defence under Ricky Stewart?
So they won 30-18 in round 26, and we were hot favourites.
Yeah.
And then we have to turn around and play them again in the first semi. Is it a qualifying final at that point, Samuel? Qualifying final.
Yeah, and
we lose that 32-20. So what are your memories of that? I believe that game was an equal number of tries and you couldn't kick a goal.
I couldn't That's kick the a goal. One, yeah. Oh, gosh. There's always been an issue at the club, has it?
Thanks for reminding us.
Yeah, thanks. No, I don't remember that. But obviously, I think it might have been... we might have had even Graham Arnold actually is our goal king coach there for a while. Yep. So he was a Sharks fan.
Really?
A soccer coach, and did a bit of work with him in goal kicking. So I didn't remember the fact that we'd scored the same amount of tries and I hadn't kicked a goal. I remember their rushing sort of style of defence. It was very big there in those couple of years, especially when Ricky took over the place, that they were going to play that rushing. And I think there was some reports of us trying to set, surrender tackles and bits and pieces on Denny Nutley and a few other things. So
this is when the screws started to get turned. Gus Gould was putting pressure on about the flat style of play and the dominant tackles and all
the
that.
The fact that the teams weren't allowed to lie on us because we finished on our elbows and knees, which in the old days, and still is now, if you land elbows and knees, you've won the battle of the attack to defence. But that's when the public, or as you said, some media pressure came on the fact that they should be allowed to have two efforts and flop on and slow us down and avoid us winning that part of the game.
I remember they were very physical matches. Chris Beattie was in stoushes in both games. We were close enough in those games.
As you said, if you had a decent goal kicker, then who knows we could have won golden point.
All right, so then that sets us up to a local derby challenge at the Sydney Football Stadium, do or die.
One of the great games.
Against the Dragons.
I was there watching that one. That was
amazing.
That was a lot of fun.
The hype of a general match against the Dragons is unbelievable, especially when, as I said, I grew up in Newcastle, so I didn't really have a local derby. I played for Melbourne. There's no such thing as a local derby. So to understand what a local derby is, you've got to be a part of either Cronulla or St. George. Mm-hmm. And I understood it very, very quickly. At that stage, there was the perception of little brother versus big brother.
Yeah, absolutely.
They were always the successful outlook and bits and pieces. But yeah, it was a good clash.
I remember, I think they might have scored first, and I'm pretty sure Phil Bailey, who I love, he was you know, partial to letting in the try that happened. It might have been Gasnier's. It was Gasnier's side. And the first try we scored, it was a set play up the left. You guys went right. And Bailey just barges over Gasnier, picks up the ball and throws it at his head, saying, you know, like, fuck you.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is unbelievable. I love it. And we went on and won the match. It was a high scoring match as well, wasn't it?
40 to 24. So 40 points.
Plenty of points, yeah. And as you said, I don't remember it too well, but I'm reckoning a lot of the points would have come late. I think that's what we did a lot of times, was we would just battle, and be in an arm wrestle and fight, and then all of a sudden, by staying calm and relaxed, but just having confidence or being super fit, I think we won a lot of games right at the end. We scored 18 points in the last 5 minutes, 7 minutes, and
yep.
And all of a sudden you go, oh, wow, they've blown them off the park.
Now it's time to talk about that word culture. You're in the end of the prelim. Public perception at this point has turned. Everybody's on board. The whole Preston thing is like largely forgotten. You know, he's been demoted to reserve grade and then sort of fades off into obscurity, which is a different story for a different day.
Mm-hmm.
And we're into a prelim and the Warriors are having their own fairy tale. It's their chance to make the grand final.
The owner, was it the owner who gave away all the free
Vodafone.
Tickets?
Vodafone Warriors fans could...
Yep. If you've got a passport...
You can turn up. Now, Chris Anderson again was on record saying that the vibe around the Sharks at semi-final time was one of almost dread rather than excitement, which is what he was used to at the Bulldogs and then the Storm. What was your take on that?
Yeah, and I think that was Chris's way of probably trying to just get people to think differently rather than just go, oh, you know, we're not here making up the numbers. We're not here just to compete. We're actually here. We're here to win. And that was the biggest thing, I think, was that you mentioned the word culture. That was the biggest thing about trying to get, I suppose, us as players and us as a community to believe that we're a good team and the fact that we deserve to be a top eight team or a top four team and a grand final side. So, you know, I feel like over times, and I've lived in the Shire now for 20 years or 19 years, you know, so I feel like I've watched that change continuously over the time that sometimes we get to the finals and we know we're going to get beat. But now there was a period there, and I think there still is a period now, where we genuinely believe that we're a top eight side, we would like to be a top four side, we're a premiership side, that we deserve to be in the finals now, which is probably a bit different to what Chris was trying to say. So I feel like the Warriors match, there was an air of excitement for the fact that, you know, we're in the grand final qualifier. Mm-hmm. We'd been through the heartache of, as you said, the biggest loss or losing streak in club's history to winning all those matches and getting better. So I felt like there was always I think about it a lot more now than I did in 02. I think it was just like, oh, just let's, you know, couldn't wait for the game to kick off.
Yeah.
Have you watched it back at all?
Not really, no. I remember certain parts of the game. I think Chris McKenna might have been under an injury cloud, I think, leading into the game or bits and pieces. And
we'd lost Matt Johns by then.
Lost Matty Johns by then. So that was probably a bit of experience.
Yeah.
You know, a senior player that had that calming influence. So it was probably... And again, the game was... It was the heartache. I think it was about the 75-minute mark when they bloody scored that try to guarantee victory for them as well. It's that heartache of we were in the contest, we were a chance of winning, we should have won, we bombed some chances, and then, as you said, the guttering feeling of that last try that they scored sort of sealed the victory for them.
Do you think it was maybe the occasion was a bit much for some of the people in the squad? I mean, it was a full ANZ stadium, and the weight of the world felt like it was behind the Warriors. I remember that quite vividly at the time.
Maybe when I go back and say about the thing called the footy gods or bits and pieces, there's some extreme elements where for some reason players are comfortable outside pressure. They've been to this finals 3 or 4 years in a row where they can handle it. So the more rep games you play, the better you get in rep games. Yeah. The more finals you play, the better you get in finals games. And as you said, there was a lot of hype in regards for the Warriors and probably put us under a lot of pressure. And you know, as you said, with Matthew Johns being out, that would have been our most experienced player out, and then maybe there was that feeling of, and maybe that's that feeling of what Chris was trying to create with the feeling in the Shire was we should be excited and confident this time of year, not nervous.
Here we go again.
Attitude, yeah. which then if that's the culture that you portray, then that's what happened. Several times.
Yeah.
It's interesting because, I mean, we had Stuart Raper and then Ricky comes along and he's, you know, a hard ass. And then we got Shane Flanagan and he's a hard ass.
Yep.
And to the point now where as Sharks fans, as you say, we expect success. And now this year, for example, in 2020, we scrape into the finals. And it's a direct result of us expecting so much success after all those years starting from...
I reckon the Ricky Stewart appointment, I'm sure that Ricky Stewart, I remember at the time, he would have pushed himself that he was going to change the culture of the club and he was going to make us into a professional outfit. He was going to bring all these sponsors.
Yeah.
And then I remember him picking on a few players at training on the fact that he thought they were talented players, but they were too soft.
Right.
And it will make you play tougher. And again, he made, you know, we had a couple of very successful years that I played under Ricky.
Yeah.
And you know what he does is he gets you, he makes your defense focus a big importance. You play really tough.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, and the guys like, you know, as you said, Chris Beattie and Jason Stevens, they were sort of the thugs of the old days, of the 90s, late, yep, early 2000s era. And then I think, you know, we talk about, you know, I think blokes like Gal and Birdie love hanging out with Jason Stevens and Denny Nutley and all those blokes, because then they created the thugness or the brutality of coming to Shark Park, and that's the style that we are. We've turned into a style of football as a club. Is like, mate, you might beat us, but you're gonna
yeah,
end up with bumped and bruised and bashed. And as you said, like, effort and train hard and fit. And
we often reflect on it, Sam. Those years with some pretty dud squads, 2011, where you got no rep. Other than Gal, you got no rep players at all. But, you know, teams always had to earn their victories, you know, because Ricky had set up that mentality. But as maligned as Chris Anderson was, I think he was right about the culture needing to change. I think his methods probably proved to be incorrect. He was a bit took too much of the culture away. But I think he was right that around finals time, if you're dreading it, something's wrong, Sam.
I mean, I'm one of those people that dreads even to this day, but yeah, that's just my life and my style. But absolutely, as a club, you know, in the 70s, some heartbreaking grand final losses, 88, minor premiers, phenomenal team with Gavin Miller and all those guys. Phenomenal team. Our friend Jonathan Docking, and bowed out in straight sets.
Yeah.
And you do become used to that as a fan.
It was the same story again in 95 when they went out in straight sets, right, against Manly.
The thing that I don't like about sort of Lange copping slightly bad rap towards the end is that he never took them to the highest place.
Yeah.
But he got them to some great places. I think every year but one, he made the finals.
And he's starting from a low base. I mean, the early 90s, the club went into receivership.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a fantastic squad. And it was when, you know, the Peachy and Rogers and those guys came along that... Yeah. That a style was developed.
And as you said, like this, and then the Shark Park on a Saturday night, oh, you know, I remember playing 21s in reserve grade there on a Saturday night. It was packed at 5:30,
yeah,
for a 7:30 kickoff.
Yeah.
You know, it was the place to be on a Saturday night in the Shire.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, it was the number one ticket in the place. So, as you said, like, there's different coaches have had great success in different areas and different styles, and they've all tried to get to that one thing. Like, I tried my ass off for 8 years to become the first player, first halfback or the first captain there for a while to win a premiership for the Sharks, and I wasn't able to achieve it. But I reckon in 2016, when they did achieve it, it was, as Gal made the comment at full time, it flicked a switch in the whole community that the pressure's off now. Like,
yeah,
we've won a premiership now, so now our expectations are,
yeah,
we're not going to fail anymore. We've achieved the greatest thing there is to play in this game for,
yeah,
and now we'd expect to be there. So, you know.
So tell us about your experience on that night. Where were you? Where were you watching
there
from?
I was there with the family. I think I was working in some capacity at the venue. I'd bought tickets. My family had all bought tickets. My children at that stage and still are massive Val Holmes fans.
Yeah.
Join the club. Yeah. So
you got the president, yeah, and chief selector of the Val Holmes.
But I'd spent 8 years. I'd spent 8 years playing for the club. I call it home now. My three of my four children have been born in the Shire. So
you played almost double the amount of games at Cronulla than anywhere else. You played,
yes,
140 games.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
People and sort of tend to forget that about your career.
Yeah, and I was, you know, as I said, one of my highlights of my actual career was the fact that I got to be the club captain here for a number of seasons as well. So, you know, that's, again, for me, that was a huge achievement, you know, about, you know, that I was looked upon as a leader, was someone that could run the team around, create the club first sort of attitude. So in my own career, you know, winning a premiership's the greatest thing I achieved, and playing rep football, but captaining your own club is a great achievement and a huge achievement I got to do. And as you said, I didn't get to retire here, which was a little bit disappointing in some regards. But I went on to Canterbury for a couple of years and played. And again, like, you know, Shark Park on a Sunday afternoon. You know, I've had four children, as I said, now three around here. They've all become Sharks fans. They all want to come to the footy. They all want to wait for that siren to go up full time to jump the fence and kick the ball around. My older three, my eldest is 19, so you know they remember the times when I played at the club. They call a lot of the players that I played with, you know, by the nicknames and friends, and yeah. It still has a huge family trait, this club. That, you know, you used to be able to take your kids down to Captain's Run, or they'd go in the park and they'd come to the presentations or barbecues and bits, yeah. And you know, in the summertime bar and all that. So I think, you know, that was a huge achievement. I didn't come down to the club at the end of the night. My older two girls and next door neighbours come down to the club late on the Sunday night when they returned with a trophy. They all went on the Monday down to the fan day. Yeah, I was relieved and glad to see him hold up the trophy.
How did you feel when Gal gave you guys a shout out? It's the perfect speech in hindsight. Perfect.
And as you said, it's the heartache of the history of the club. Yeah. You know, no one had been able to achieve it. Gal's our, and has become the best player our club's ever had, the most capped player our club's ever had. He's the first captain our club's ever had. So, you know, and it was we'd all set out with the same dream, yeah. I suppose, and goal that we wanted to win a premiership. So,
yeah.
which then raises the level of the club that, okay, we've won a premiership, which is now only 5 years ago. We haven't missed the finals, I think, for a long 8 years or 9 years, I think it is now. So, you know, I think, you know, it's changed the fact that we're not just a side that'll hopefully get to the finals and go out the back door. Hopefully now, I'd like to think the branding and the perception of the place is that we're knocking on the door of becoming those top four sides continuously, becoming a Melbourne and becoming a Roosters in theory. You know, if you talk about the Collingwood brandings and bits and pieces, you know.
Well, when you think about how the club's now widely disliked amongst the wider rugby league community, then you success. Know you're doing something right,
yeah.
Hey?
Yeah. Sometimes I think, you know, we're the easy target to put a shot on from the media. Like, we're the first club that always has to fold. Yeah. Yeah. We're going to Perth. We're relocating. We're, you know, you're not even playing at home. Your roster's crap. You know, bits and pieces. And there's been some mute. Like, we've probably had some of the biggest roadblocks or hiccups or challenges
absolutely.
In the last... I talk about from 2002 onwards, which is probably when I started caring about the club because it's your home and it's your club that you play for. But, you know, as you said, that what'd you say, the early 90s, they were broke.
Yep.
I remember it even many now. Times. When we go and talk to a few of the long-term partners, or not long-term partners, some people who've got corporate suites or open-air boxes that have been around from day one, they talk about the old days of being broke and raffles and bits and pieces of stuff. So it's been through a heartache, but the last 5 years, 10 years, it's been
good times.
Good times, bloody challenging times. And as you said, you know, there's been some great celebrations.
So just to reflect on 2002, as I look back on it, it was a bit of an end of an era. There was a successful era of the club.
Yep.
The end of the John Lang era. Opes' first year was successful. You make a prelim. 2003, the wheels fall off, and then there's a rebuilding phase. What's your final takeaway on it?
2002, as you said, it was probably I come to kickstart my career after being not happy with how I played at the Northern Eagles, to booed off the field, booed then from the fans on the field, biggest loss period of my whole career, to then playing the best football we've played for a number of years and get to that grand final qualifier, which created heartache. I was lucky enough to then secure a deal for a number of years after that, so I felt like I'd achieved what I wanted to achieve by getting my football back to where it had to become. And as you said, like I remember playing in 2003, and just going back on Chris, like I think he was on the verge of, there was rumblings of him being moved on from the club. I'd broke my jaw during the year and had a little plate put in the side of my jaw, and I was still blending. I wasn't eating solids. I was blending food. I was cutting tiny bits of meat off so I could have it, because ice cream for breakfast, lunch and dinner is not really enjoyable. I remember seeing the doctor at the time and I said, I need to play. And he's like, why? I said, is my jaw okay? I got the approval or the clearance from the doctor that I was fine to play. It was roughly about the same time I was due to come back anyway. And I went to Chris and said, I've got to play. And he said, no, you're not cleared. I said, I saw the doctor yesterday. I'm cleared. I'm going to, can you pick me? And that was in return my repay to him for everything he'd done for my career. Because, you know, as I said, we had that great success in Melbourne and the start of my journey. And I still call Chris a great friend and a mentor of mine now. But so he got my football back. So 02 was the most challenging part of my whole career ever. And then it was a reward. So in some regards, it was my way of thanking him that I had to play that the game that I ended up getting injured the game after I come back, but that was a different injury. It was a bit more painful one than the broken jaw.
Yeah. The one you're talking about, yeah.
The old ruptured.
Yeah, the ruptured testicle. Yeah. Oh, God. But,
like, literally busting the nut.
And yes. then not long after that, the club made the decision to move Chris on, which I was really, really disappointed with. But, you know, it was my way of thanking him for everything he'd done for my career was the fact that I just had to play. So it was disappointing that we didn't have a successful reign under Chris.
What is your take on that? Because he made some very, very unpopular scything changes. Got rid of a lot of favourite sons of the club. The squad from 2002 was unrecognisable, and he went down this, you know, get me 14 athletes and a halfback. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty wild moves. What was your take on that?
I think there was, as you said, there was things that he'd changed that created a change and a better for the club. I think Stuart Raper tapped onto that a little bit more, because Stuart obviously brought back the more feeling of the club again, because he'd been through the lower grades and he'd played for the place and that is understanding. So I thought Stuart and Adrian Lamb tapped into a little bit of everything that Chris created in that tough culture, but with the family orientated, the Sharks way, and then Ricky took it to a whole new level again. So, I think sometimes we've got to make change to go forward, or make change just to become a better franchise or a better organisation, or at least we've got to look at what we're doing behind to help ourselves. So Chris had a great success, obviously, at Canterbury, at Melbourne. He's a Halifax legend. He's coached Australia. So, you know, I think he would look back and go, well, you know, kept the club together for the losing streak, which is hard to do.
Yep.
And then pushed us nearly to winning a grand final in 02. And then, as you said, disappointingly, it didn't work out.
How was the relationship with you and, like, some of those guys, like Treister, Graham, I guess Preston to an extent, but he'd gone by that point. But when Treister and Nick Graham were sort of benched, for example.
I was in disbelief at those decisions.
Did it affect you guys as a squad?
No, not too much. No, I felt there in some regards there was probably a little bit of there was an us and a them, because they were the old brigade, and it was like the Nutley had come in, the Bailey had come in, the Matty Johns and myself, you know, and we'd go out and have coffee with Chris or breakfast with Chris, because that was the type of coach he was, you know. So, you know, go and have a beer with the coach and bits and pieces. So, that it was probably friendly there for a while, but then obviously, it's. I think people don't like getting dropped. People, you know, it's
or
not
sacked.
Or sacked. But yeah, I got sacked from here as well, and you know, I wasn't a nice feeling. You don't go and say to the guy who sacked you, "Oh, thanks for that. Yeah, I really appreciate it." Yeah, like you know, so, and that's what creates, that's what upsets clubs and wrecks friendships, because honestly, sometimes you can't see it at the time, but in their mind, they've got a job to do and they do it for their reasons. But if you're the brunt of the person being dropped or sacked, then it's difficult.
Yeah.
What about you and Presto in 02? Like, because there was so much media speculation and hype and push, and here comes Noddy, and out goes the 2001 legend.
And his form just went off a cliff. Like,
Presto and I never had a problem. Training wise, playing wise, bits and pieces. Chris had sold it to me and to Preston at the time that he thought Preston could play dummy half and still be equally as dangerous in the team, and started that way, obviously. You know, Preston and Dean Treister shared the dummy half role for a while. But then, as you said, it never worked out, and that was, you know, Preston never had a go at me. We never had any issues. Yeah. It was just something that he solved with Chris, and as you said, made a decision to leave the club.
All right, so just before we wrap it up, I think I know the answer to this. Do you think if things went differently against the Warriors and you roll into the grand final, you could have won the comp?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Definitely.
Okay.
Now, I think we're, as you said, the hard part for that would have been that there was no Matthew Johns, which hurts us. They, you know,
because I think Birdie played.
Birdie played, but Birdie was very young and probably not the same.
You know, oh, he was a rookie.
a rookie.
Is that his rookie year? Was it?
Yeah. 02, yeah. So 17-year-old kid moves from Newcastle to Cronulla and
he had no belief in himself.
He had the confidence.
Yeah, he had a little bit of confidence. You know, but again, I'm going to say the Roosters were probably full strength, no dramas. It was the start of Ricky's reign there, which is that tough and over the headline.
Yeah.
Well, the Warriors all but had him beat until near the end. You know, yeah. If you think about the game, the Richard Villasani tackle on Freddie when it splits his head open.
Yeah.
Bits and pieces. They had that, the fairy tale of the fans. I suppose everyone was going for the Warriors, not the Roosters, if you weren't a Roosters fan. So,
yeah.
I think we might have won. I was probably more shattered about the 08 loss than the 02 loss. Because as you get older, you understand how hard these things are to make.
Well, I mean, it was a long mountain to climb back to get to 08, yeah. wasn't it? There were some lean years.
Very, very lean years. And I think when you're younger, and I'd played every year where I nearly made a grand final, made the semis or bits and pieces. I'd played in 97 Super League World Cup grand final, and then 98 we got beaten the first week. 99 we win the comp, 2000 beat the first week. Yep. 01 was a bit of a tough year, but then 02 we
bounce straight back.
So I just sort of thought that's where footy was. So
yeah.
You don't realise till you get a bit older and this game's a bit harder and you don't get lucky every year and building the roster is bloody hard work and being fit at the end of the year. So and 08 I suppose was hard because I knew I was leaving the club. I wanted to sort of finish on a good note and maybe prove a person wrong.
Okay.
But it was disappointing that we didn't get there.
Tell me about playing with one of my favourite players, possibly my favourite player, David Peachy. What's he like? What was it like?
He was a freak. And I've played some charity games with Peach over the last few years and just floats around the park like he did back then. He was a great athlete. He just would play football, eyes up, good catch of the ball, great communicator. Mm. A really good bloke. You know, I think he enjoyed his life. He was a freak. He's one of those natural footy players that you couldn't really say, you got to stay here, you got to go there, you got to do this. But, he was a freak and great to play with.
Okay.
What a great player to watch, wasn't he?
Oh, he got people through the turnstiles.
I used to hate him at fitness, though, because when we used to do a lot of 100-metre runnings, he'd do about 14 steps and I'd do about 95.
He had that beautiful, beautiful gliding stride. Yeah, didn't he? Yeah. He used to glide across the grass. Great to watch. Well, thanks very much, Noddy. It's been a fascinating chat, really. It was a strange year to think, you know, that everything changed so much. It started off looking like a dud and then come good and then came home with a wet sail and so much going on. The Preston story, Matty Johns, some floggings and then turning around and winning 64-16.
A lot happened. Tell us, Brett, about your role at the club now. What's going on?
I work in the club in sort of business development role and helping with some sponsors.
Okay.
I did a little bit of coaching when Shane, the last year Shane was at the club.
Yeah.
As you said, I'd sort of left the club in 08 and hadn't returned until 2 years ago. So it was actually really nice to be a part of the club again. And I'd love to be. I'm trying to do a bit more stuff with football, bits and pieces. I'm going to hopefully help out with some junior stuff. So,
cool.
Yeah, I'd love to be. My family will always be on the hill sitting down there. We'll always be fans of the club and hopefully I can have a big impact in the success of our club.
Are we talking potential some sort of coaching role? Is that your aspiration? I'm not necessarily saying head coach. I'm just saying.
Depends what day you ask me. I retired from football to actually be a head coach because of Chris Anderson. My whole dream in life was to.
Really?
I wanted to be a head coach. I went down
Did you coach NYC?
Yes. I retired at Canterbury and was a specialist coach. I went to Canberra Raiders for 2 years as the NRL assistant coach.
Oh.
I coached the NYC tide at the West Tigers because they tell me you got to have your own side. And then I didn't like the direction they were going in. Okay. So, and then when my partner got sick and things changed in life, literally it's my whole coaching my whole coaching aspirations, I literally put in the bin and said, become a dad first and juggle more with media stuff. And now I'm slowly getting back into football. So,
yeah, cool.
I wake up some days thinking I would love to coach, and then I look at them and go, don't be an idiot. I'd love to be involved in the club. I feel like I have some great partners. You know, I'm an ambassador for EISS Super Company. I work for Channel 7 and commentate for Croc Media. So I feel like I've got some nice relationships that are forever relationships, hopefully, and working for the club a couple of days a week. If I can be a huge impact in using my knowledge and helping our success from off the field, that would be a big part of what I could contribute.
You know what we got here? We got a great shark.
We do.
One of the greats.
Was it the team of the century? Is that what it was?
Is that why we come down here to the yacht club till we're on the water? You guys are clever.
Oh, it's a magic day. Just watching one of the boats pull out. Nice. About five or six
How
blokes got
on there.
How many
of these do you own, Brett? Which one's yours?
No, unfortunately, the salary cap when I played was a little bit different to what I was now.
There we go. Yeah. Yeah. Played Super League
down.
And everything.
I'm down in Woolaware. Like, oh, yeah. You know, I'm just on the...
Anyway, we just seen a boat pull out and they've got like... There's about six or seven guys on there, and they've almost put a pallet of booze on there, so they're ready for a good day out.
We have one more question for Brett, which he doesn't know about.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, what boat does Paul Gallen own?
He'd have a few, too, wouldn't he?
He'd have a few, wouldn't he?
Brett, we've got a question, non-sporting question for you.
Of all of our guests.
Take as much time as you need, and Adam will do a drum roll in between. What is your favourite musical artist of all time, band or artist?
All time, if you've got to pick one.
All time. I'm going to say I know this person. He's helped me out personally.
Oh, wow.
I'm a huge fan of all his music.
Yeah.
Local Australian.
Yeah.
Guy Sebastian.
Really?
Guy Sebastian.
Huge, yeah.
Excellent. There you go.
Yeah.
That's our
I'll say this
field.
About Guy, one of the most natural voices I've ever heard. And when he was on Australian Idol... The record companies were going, this is money right here.
Yeah.
This is money.
I remember when he won Australian Idol, I was working for St. George Bank at the time, and they wheeled him into the Christmas party just to like do two songs.
Yeah,
and he'd obviously done the Christmas party like circuit. He just came in, sang two songs with like eyes like dinner plates, and then they just wheeled him out.
Yeah, right. How did you meet Guy?
One of my very good friends is one of Guy's best friends.
Okay.
He helped us out a few years ago. With some family stuff,
yep.
And then he's just a lovely fella, knockabout guy. And
does he like footy from memory?
He does. He's obviously from Adelaide, so he's more of an AFL man.
Gotcha.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah, he does watch a little bit of rugby league. So
okay, yeah, talented guy. My God,
is that tattoo on your bicep?
Mm.
I could see the colours of the tattoo.
It's not a Melbourne Storm tattoo.
I just saw the purple and yellow, and I was like, "Oh,
no,
hang
it's
on
not a Melbourne Storm
tattoo."
How
are we doing a shark?
Not a Melbourne Storm tattoo.
Oh wow, it's a Melbourne Storm. Like,
no one's ever. It is those colours though, and I'm like,
I've got
wow.
the same tattoos on my right cheek, obviously from the
Premiership.
From the Premiership. So every player and staff member from that time all got tattoos. So I think successful teams are also teams that are super close.
Yeah,
you know, and they hang out.
Was that your first tattoo?
Yes, yes.
Were you okay with it? You're like, yeah, let's do it.
Oh, we all did it. We all went, a few days after celebrating a
didn't
win.
Really feel it.
Silly Sunday.
But yeah, the silly Tuesday, I think it might have been.
How so. Good.
All right, well, let's wrap it up. Samuel, thanks very much for coming on board. It's been a really great, illuminating chat. And we'll see you around the traps, eh?
Do it again.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Noddy.
The Royal Motor Yacht Club, Port Hacking, is a hidden gem of the Shire, situated on the banks of the beautiful Port Hacking, and is the best venue around for lunch, dinner, casual catch-up with friends, or function.
They always show NRL games live on the big screens, and Sunday arvos are superb, with live acoustic music in the beer garden, while the boats frame the backdrop. And you mean I love acoustic music, you know that?
Yachty's Bistro is open 7 days and nights, serving great food, and if you mention Sharkcast Radio, you get a free...
garlic bread, baby.
The RMYC Port Hacking, Woolaware Road, Woolaware, or check out their Facebook feed to see what's on.
Sharkies! Sharkies!
Slides off because they're coming out with